to the Julie Chan Show, where passion meets purpose. So happy to be here today with Erica Komisar, who is a licensed clinical social worker and has written her second book that is just out. It is Chicken Little, The Sky Isn't Falling. Well, I think many of us feel like the sky is falling, and you are a parenting expert there in New York City, where I'm sure, I mean, there are questions by parents and adolescents all over the world, but I imagine it is very heightened in New York City, where the stress is always extraordinarily high. How are you doing?
Well, I mean, as a mother of three children, I have older adolescent and young adult children. I see what's happening through their eyes, and I'm incredibly concerned for them. But in terms of being a therapist, I'm busier than I've ever been. I mean, I would say every therapist has a very long wait list at this point. And so, it's a very particular time in history. I think what's happened is there were always feelings of anxiety and depression, but I think COVID was an amplifier and kind of took the lid off of a lot of people's defenses. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that lid is going back on anytime soon.
Right. Mm-hmm. And fear is so heightened. Mm-hmm. That it's a lot. Mm-hmm. But first, I want to talk about your passion and your purpose for doing this work. What was it for you, either in your own adolescence or in your younger years, that propelled you to choose a career first as a social worker and then as a therapist?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's a good question. So I tried a lot of things when I was a young woman. I tried a lot of different kinds of careers and found myself really loving being in my own therapist's office. Found it to be a very peaceful and contemplative place. And I was happiest there. And I said, right, this is what I want to do. But based on my own childhood, I would say I had a pretty hard adolescence. My adolescence was not easy. I was bullied, and which was not easy. And my parents were very loving, but they didn't really know how to help me. And so I think it gave me a lot of inspiration to want to help parents. When I was a young social worker, before I went back for my psychoanalytic training, I worked in Brooklyn. And I found that what was missing with the whole therapeutic process was really like psychoeducational work with parents, meaning helping parents who may not have had the best parents themselves, may have had mothers who were not bad people, but may have been depressed or distracted or abstinent one way or another, really helping those parents to learn to parent. And I found that to be incredibly rewarding work when I was a young social worker and therapist. And I started doing parenting seminars in clinics and then in schools and then in corporations. I mean, I've worked in companies like Goldman Sachs and big law firms like Sherman and Sterling. In the old days, I was really going everywhere that would let me come and talk to parents about parenting. Because there's so much misunderstanding and confusion and misinformation about parenting. I really wanted to address it. And so those are some of my inspirations for being a parent guidance expert and being a therapist and writing the books that I do.
Amazing. It's amazing how our childhood shapes us so much in what we desire and what we want to impart in the world based on our own experiences. And it's amazing that you realize while you had very loving parents, the bullying that happened outside was maybe even unbeknownst to your parents at the time, but to give other parents that window, that door of realization that even though they're at work in these high powered positions, or maybe, you know, the volunteer of the PTA, that their kids are going through something so different and how they can actually be present.
And, you know, I think my parents lived in a time in history where bullying was contained to a small group of kids in a school. There was no social media. There was no, I think today it would have been even more impossible for my parents to really understand what to do. So, you know, this book that you held up, Chicken Little, is really what I think of as a comprehensive mental health guide for parents. Each chapter is on a different issue that may come up for parents. There's a chapter on eating disorders. There's a chapter on anxiety, depression. There's a chapter on drug and alcohol addiction. There's a chapter on ADHD and learning disabilities. There's a chapter on gaming and video addiction. I mean, on and on. So each chapter has a different focus. And in each chapter is a way for parents to prevent these things, but also to identify literally lists of things that we use as clinicians. It's sort of sharing my insider information with parents. How do we diagnose learning disabilities? How do we diagnose an eating disorder? And then looking for what we call the intensity and the chronicity, meaning how many symptoms they show and how long they've been showing them. And right. then instructing parents really how to get help and in what order they should get help. Because parents are very confused and feel very overwhelmed when these issues come up. And I think the tendency is to want to pull away. The tendency is to want to deny or go into a defensive state. Oh, everything will be fine. Mm-hmm. Go away. And just it's developmental. Some of it is, but some of it isn't. And to right. really get help as quickly as possible for your children when they're starting to really show signs that they're under stress. But I really think of it as, you could literally read the whole thing and then you could pick up the book and use it like a guide. So you'd pick right. it up if your child is showing signs of any one of these issues.
Right. Well, it sounds almost like an encyclopedia of sorts where you can go to that one section, whether it's for video gaming or just addiction to all of the social media, all yep. different ADHD, I know is a huge one. Yep. So many issues. I love, though, that your first book was called Being There. And really for parents as they're starting out in this parenting journey that unfortunately we don't get the handbook for when we are in college, when it probably would have been really helpful to have even one class about how we are going to be so effective or potentially ineffective as new parents. Could you talk about your passion and your real purpose for the guidance you wanted to impart in that first book versus the second book?
Yeah, I really wanted parents to understand how neurologically fragile children are. And I think that's really important because I think as a society, we impose on very young children you'd say we project upon them that they are more sturdy than they actually are. We assume, what they say, never assume it makes an ass of you and me. We assume as a society that children are born resilient, they're born strong, they're capable of dealing with stress at a very young age. We basically project onto them our adult-like resilience. And that's just inaccurate because children, infants are born incredibly neurologically fragile and need a great deal of us in the first 3 years to provide them with a sense of safety, security, consistency, and the ability to soothe them from moment to moment is what lays down that foundation. So born, there's very few creatures, mammals included, where our young are born so very fragile that they need us for such a long time. Mm-hmm. And where without us being there, without that attachment security, and people get the whole idea of attachment security confused too. They think, oh, I gave birth, I was home for 6 weeks, my baby was attached to me, now my baby is attached securely. What they don't understand is it's not just the early days of having an infant, but it's actually the days that follow. Every day that follows is a reinforcement of the day before. Because babies have very short-term memory, they need our secure presence physically and emotionally reinforced over and over and over and over again. So every day that we wake up and it's like Groundhog Day and we're reassuring our child when they're in distress, when they're crying, when they're scared, when they have skin-to-skin contact with us, they have our attention, they have our soothing voice. That is that reinforcement over the first 1,000 days of a baby's life is what lays down the foundation for what we call emotional security, on which the house of that personality is built. And when we don't build that house strong, when we don't build that foundation strong, the house blows down, you'd say, to use the little pig analogy. Like a house of straw. So there's a big push in our country for institutional daycare. And I use the word institutional because it is institutional. Institutional daycare, or leaving our children younger and younger to satisfy our needs for our own careers. And that's all wonderful, except what we know is that children aren't capable of building that foundation without their secure attachment figure there. I think it's, I wanted to educate people. There's neuroscience behind this. There's epigenetics research. There's attachment research. So what I do is I take all that research and I make it accessible to parents and social workers and policymakers to read the book and really understand what are the fundamental emotional needs of children in the first 3 years.
And then you went on to write the second book, because in case for all those parents who are watching and realizing that they weren't there, that they were only able to be there for the first 6 weeks, don't have to feel like you are doomed and that there's no recovering, right? Because you get a second opportunity to rebuild that house for your children, and that's in adolescence. Talk about that.
So there are two critical windows of brain development. So by the age of 3, 85% of a child's right or social emotional brain is developed. Now that social emotional brain is responsible for things like emotional regulation, resilience to stress, the ability to read social cues, the ability to be empathic towards others and really interact with others, to have deep relationships. Okay, so all of those things, and in addition to that, things like executive functioning, working memory, so many things, 85% is developed in the first 3 years. What we know is from that point, from about 3 to 9, there is the rest of the brain development, of the right brain development going on. So let's say there's an excess of what we call neurogenesis, too many cells. By 9 years old, what happens is pruning, you know, like you go outside and prune your bushes outside in your yard, you know, because they're overgrown. Think of the right brain as by 9 being kind of overgrown, right? By adolescence, it's like bushes that are grown wild, right? And you need to pare them down so you're only keeping what they need. Because if you have too many cells, the brain sort of short circuits, right? So then from 9 to 25, you have another opportunity because the brain is doing this thing, which is it's reorganizing and it's pruning all the cells it doesn't need. And the environment is what helps that pruning process and that reorganization process to go smoothly. So when I say you have another opportunity, you have a second critical window, which is 9 to 25. We know now that adolescence is longer than we've ever known before. It starts earlier and ends later. And we can see this now using technology and brain scans, that we thought that adolescence was 13 to 19, maybe 100 years ago when the term adolescence was invented, because before then there was just childhood and adulthood. There was no adolescence. We created that term to describe the in-between, right? Not a child, not an adult, right? But when we first created it, we had no technology. We had no science behind it. And so now we actually know that because of puberty and what's happening with hormones, it starts earlier, as early as 9, and it ends later, meaning the last part of the right brain to develop, the prefrontal cortex, which is really responsible for keeping emotions from going too high and too low, doesn't finish developing till 25. So we have this period where the environment, right, the environment is critical. And who's the environment? We're the environment in the first 3 years. We're pretty much exclusively the environment right. In the first 3 years. In adolescence, we're a very big piece of the environment. The environment is also school, socializing, their friends, right? Their interests, everything outside of the home. But we're still a very big part of their environment. And parents don't really understand just how big a part of their environment you actually are, because they seem to not need you and they seem to push you away. But you're actually a very important part, still processing their experiences, their feelings, their friendships, things that are happening or not happening for them. When we're present as much as possible, physically and emotionally, to help them process their emotions and experiences, we are actually doing what we did when they were little. We're soothing them from moment to moment. Now, we can't be there in the same way as when they were babies, but the more we can be there, the more we can be there to process those feelings with them. And that is how they learn to process them themselves.
And so in those years, those adolescent years, which, by the way, I had no idea it was such a large window. So it's like good and bad, right? Because that's like another 16 years that are really important, from what you're saying, to really be present and to be there when they want us to be there, which is what's really hard, right? Because we go and make our own plans because they're always pushing us away. But to make sure that we're there in those moments that they are ready to talk or need to talk. And if we miss those moments, they're gone.
I use a term in the book, which is be there when the door opens. And I use that as a literal thing, because they close their doors a lot, right? And they don't want us in the rooms. But they also put up defenses, which are healthy defenses. They need to create defenses because they need to learn to start to be more independent. So the pushing us away is a way to create space between them and us to really practice being grown-ups, right? They're not grown-ups, but they have to start to practice being more independent. But I think parents get fooled by the defenses. They think the defenses are the whole picture. They're only a piece of the picture, because in fact, they still very much need us, but they need us on their terms. It's what you said a moment ago. They need us when they need us. So literally, when the door opens and they come upstairs or outside their room, or they're looking for something to eat, or they're looking for you, and you might not know they're looking for you. They come out for stimulation, whatever, for a break, and you're there. That's your opportunity. How are you doing? How's your studying going? How's your day today? If you're not there when the door opens, then the door closes again. They go, they poke their heads out like a turtle poking out of the shell. And they say, right, no one's there to comfort me. No one's there to help me process. I'll just go back in again. They go back in the room. Now you come home from your day or being out or work or whatever, and you knock on their door, and now the door's closed. And they may not be receptive to you coming in. So it's really, defenses are such that it has to be on their terms. And that's hard for parents, because parents want control. They want to do it on their terms. But it's the practice of letting go of control, I would say, in a way. Being a parent to an adolescent is the practice of letting go of some of the control.
Yeah. And I think beyond control, it's about managing your time, at least for me, in a way that you're not overscheduled, that you allow for space and time and for sitting there and being around and available, as opposed to having an overstacked schedule.
Yeah. And, you know, when kids are little, what I advise parents is not that they don't work, but that they work when their children are working. Children have their own work. That's what Montessori, that's what Maria Montessori would say. Children have their own work, which is play, which is going to school. So if you can organize your work when they're at school, that's best, right? And so not everybody has that ability, but I encourage more and more mothers to be entrepreneurial and find ways to work when their children work and be around when their children are around. And so there's really something to that, even when they get older, yeah. Which is when they're at school, you have sometimes 7, 8, if they have activities, hours, you know, between 6 and 8 hours of them doing their work and being away from home. But when they come home, then you being available, you know, you making cookies, you cooking dinner, sitting in their room, you know, reading a book while they're doing their homework, you know, whatever they need from you, it's being physically and emotionally available. It's being available. Right. And, you know, and that means that we have to be disciplined. And that's hard because, yes. You know, not to let our work leak into, we all have important work to do, but nothing's more important than our children in the end. I think if you asked any parent, they would say, no, my children are the most important thing. But it's very hard to create boundaries with our work where we say, right, we're not going to look at our emails past 5 o'clock right. or 8 o'clock, whatever, you know, or we're not going to do our work until our children go to sleep. Or it's very hard to create those boundaries. And I find it's actually impacting adults' mental health too, to not have boundaries with work. Right. You know, if you go to other parts of the world, they have better boundaries than we do in America. We have very poor boundaries with our work. You know, in France, people don't work on weekends. You know, we have very poor boundaries. We work on weekends. We work at night. We work all the time. It's yeah. always integrated and an insidious part of our life. Right. When we have children, they really need us to have very good boundaries with our work.
Mm-hmm. And know that they're valued and important. And that we can turn our device off to focus on them. Yeah. Yes, very difficult. I know. The worst is to be called out on, are you listening? Did you hear me? Oh, wait, you're looking at your device again.
That's right. That's right. And they
are teenagers. So if we're doing that, then they think that's okay for them to always be doing that.
Yeah, you can't lie to a teenager. They really have. They have lie meters. They have, you know, radar for when we're not telling the truth. So I right. think
their intuition is just so profound.
It's profound. And so, you know, when they catch you, it's, I say this in the book, take responsibility for when you've done something wrong. It's very hard, but it's very important that, you know, taking responsibility for when you've made a mistake, admitting that you've made a mistake, admitting that you're wrong. Models for our children who are all so perfectionistic today. There is such an incline towards perfectionism and kind of a trend towards, needing to be perfect. And I think the reality is the only way we are mentally healthy is if we're not perfect and we accept our imperfections, but how can we accept them if our parents can't admit when they're imperfect? Every time you, admit to your children that you're wrong or say you're sorry with great integrity and authenticity, you are modeling something for them, which is mental health.
That is a wonderful reminder and so true and so easy as a parent to overlook and to be in a rush or to not want to show that piece because that also takes a lot of vulnerability.
It does.
And it can be very difficult. But yes, I have seen very recently in my own interaction with my kids to be able to sit them down and to have those conversations and to admit fault. As difficult as it is, which you don't think it's as difficult as it is, and but to also just see their own masks come off and almost their shock that you can do that. You just can open up other doors that you don't realize.
I think the saying goes, when you're defensive, you're not listening. You've stopped listening. But I think, you know, when you're defensive, you also have disconnected from the person you're with. So defensiveness is the disconnect. Mm-hmm. And vulnerability is the source of connection, right? Yeah. When we're vulnerable with people, you know, it's, again, you could say that taking the risk of being vulnerable, you can get hurt. But if there's someone that you want to take the risk with, it's your children. You have
absolutely
to, you're going to be close, right?
It's also interesting how, you know, we as adults can sometimes be very vulnerable and connected with our peers and our friends, but not with our kids,
right?
Because we have spent a life of, you know, thinking that we have to set a tone and be in control and wear a mask that we never meant to wear.
Well, it's also how we, you know, if you were raised with parents who weren't really close, loved you but couldn't be close to you, loved you but didn't understand you, then, you know, loved you but never took responsibility for their own mistakes or vulnerabilities or failings, right? So, you know, the point at which it's called generational transmission. So it's not genetically passed down, right? Parenting is not genetically passed down. It is generationally passed down, which means that how you were parented, you will parent unless you go and talk to somebody and are in treatment and really examine yourself. You'd say self-awareness is a big part of the book too. There's a whole chapter on what I call looking in the mirror as a parent, because it's so critical that you are self-aware and that you are someone who is self-reflective and can examine yourself. Because if you cannot examine yourself, you cannot, and you can't examine the dynamics of the family that you have come from, you will inevitably repeat those dynamics with your children. We call it neurotic repetition. It is an unconscious thing that we do with our children what was done with us unless we are examining ourselves and being self-aware.
Right. And sometimes doing all of those things is really tough, but I've come to realize that the home you've grown up in is all you know, right? So you assume that that is the role every mother plays or every father plays, and that is how every mother handles situations or shows love, et cetera. But I have found it to be really profound to have opportunities to get to know other parents who are older and to see the way they parent, you know, friends of mine, and how different people come at situations so differently. And how is that? And to get a glimpse, or when you get that opportunity to get a glimpse into other people's world and how they've been parented or how they're parenting, can be also really supportive in realizing what your journey's been like and maybe what you don't want and how to do something else.
Mm-hmm. It's very instructive. So I agree.
Yeah. So wonderful to be with you today and to hear about your own journey and what really drove you to do this work and to be a parenting expert and guide so many others. I look forward to talking with you again and learning more about what you do and how you help people. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I look forward to speaking to you again.
Absolutely. Thank you everyone for watching The Julie Chan Show, where passion meets purpose.
This broadcast is brought to you by WinJack Studios. We are an all-in-one educational platform for podcasters that revolutionizes how hosts leverage content to increase engagement with listeners, downloads, and income. We come together to focus on community, collaboration, and collective impact. For more information on how you can interact directly with our hosts, access exclusive live content with offers you can't get anywhere else from our official partners, join our purpose-driven community by visiting www.winject.com. If you're ready to build a career doing what you love, then we're ready to see you there.